This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
The next half hour focusing on U.S. automakers. First up, we want to take a look at Ford. Shares tumbling today, the most in 7 months. That news after the close yesterday that inflation is pushing supplier costs $1 billion higher than expected in the current quarter, really joining the chorus of major corporations warning about challenges rippling through the economy. We're kind of starting to hear the same story.
Yeah, 12.4% to the downside, the lowest, biggest one-day drop, I should say, in 7 months. Let's get into it with Keith Naughton, auto reporter for Bloomberg News. He joins us this afternoon on the phone. Hey, Keith, good to have you with us. Give us an idea of why this caught investors so off guard here. I mean, what changed for Ford that caused the company to come out and say inflation is costing us $1 billion more than we expected?
Yeah, I mean, there's really two aspects of this. There's the inflation piece that's driving costs up, but they also have thousands and thousands of very profitable SUVs and pickup trucks that are stacking up unfinished because they still can't get the parts they need, things like semiconductors. So investors had sort of felt like the supply shortage issue was over and we've moved on. And this is a big proof point that that's still a problem. And when you can't finish your cars for lack of parts, then you can't book those sales and make those profits. So as a result, you know, Ford's third quarter, income is going to be less than half what it was in the second quarter. It's really a big bite, and that took investors by surprise.
So it's not a demand falling story. It's just a case of we don't have all the things we need to finish up the trucks and SUVs and get them out there.
Right, and GM faced a similar situation earlier this year. I mean, you can catch up. They will finish those trucks, and they expect the fourth quarter to be stronger. So they didn't change their guidance for the full year. But, you know, when you have such a significant profit warning for the third quarter, it's unexpected. And investors don't like those sorts of downside surprises. And as I said, it underscores the negatives in this cyclical industry. And investors are always wary about those sorts of issues, inflation, demand, supply. And if those start rearing their head, they just fell off.
Hey, Keith, we had Mario Cordero, the executive director at the Port of Long Beach on yesterday. He talked to us about how, at least from his perspective, things seem to be easing a little bit. He gave the example of, 11 or 12 ships off the coast instead of more than 100 that we saw last in January.
Right.
What do investors, though, when it comes to autos and sort of the higher tech components that these autos are waiting for, need to understand about where we are in the supply chain? Because we have heard, you know, whether it's like Susquehanna or, you know, more about chip lead times coming down a little bit.
They are absolutely coming down. And that situation is improving, but it's not fixed yet. And there's another wrinkle to it. You know, the automakers are making this transition to electric vehicles. Well, electric vehicles require more chips. They're more high tech. They're more electronic. And so, you know, to finish an electric vehicle takes more chips than it does to finish an internal combustion engine vehicle. So even as as some of the shortages begin to ease on semiconductors, and they're not gone, but they've begun to improve, you know, you have vehicles that demand more of them. So that creates a new bottleneck, and that's going to be around for a while.
Hey, Keith, I do wonder that these SUVs and trucks that Ford can't finish up and get them off the assembly line and out to customers, is there the chance, because they don't have the components they need to finish them up, that by the time they are done, that demand will have fallen? Or are these cars that are already sold?
You know, they feel like pent-up demand from the pandemic still is there. Their supply of cars on dealer lots is still very scant, so they really are selling these things as soon as they come off the delivery truck. You know, will that continue forever? Hard to know, but the factories still are not back up to full capacity, and they still have a lot of demand for the product. So they feel like as soon as they finish these things off, and believe it or not, they roll them off the assembly line and they park them in parking lots waiting to put these chips in. So that's the situation. But once they can ship them off to the dealers, they're confident they have buyers waiting.
Yeah, I mean, my dad's one of those buyers. His his Mach-E that he's been, you know, he's ordered for more than a year ago, Keith. He got an email a few weeks ago. It actually went into production yesterday. And I texted him. I said, happy, you know, Mach-E production day. And he said, we'll see when it actually arrives. What do you think? Is he going to get it in the next 2 weeks, or is it going to sit there and wait for a chip?
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't take the over-under on that one.
Okay.
I think it could be a while. And that's the thing. People are waiting, you know, literally for a year to get some of these high-demand, you know, electric vehicles. The Ford F-150 Lightning, the electric pickup truck, had 200,000 orders before it even rolled the first one off the assembly line. So, you know, the waiting lists are vast.
Great demand, good problem to have, but you want to make sure you can get them into the hands of customers. Keith Naughton, thank you so much. Busy guy finding time for us. Bloomberg News auto reporter Keith Naughton on the road doing another story.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, leaders from around the world descending on Midtown Manhattan this week for the 77th session of the UN General Assembly. First day of the high-level general debate is today. U.S. President Joe Biden addresses the Assembly tomorrow, and we certainly have a lot of presence there.
Yeah, we've got, including Anne-Marie Hordern. She's Washington correspondent for Bloomberg News. She's up in New York for this. She's live from the UN here in New York City. Follow her on Twitter at Anne-Marie. Anne-Marie, good to have you with us this afternoon. I know it's been a really long day for you, so we appreciate you taking the time here. What do we need to know? What does our audience need to know about what's happened thus far? And then what happens when the action goes, you know, kicks off tomorrow, too?
Yeah, well, we all know the UN General Assembly and the UN in general really suffers from not being able to have jurisdiction over things like a war in Ukraine. Russia is on the Security Council. They've used the veto card more than any other member. We should note, followed just under the United States. But really what this is going to be facilitating is a number of bilateral meetings on the side where leaders can come together. And the two big topics right now are obviously Ukraine, especially as we might hear from President Vladimir Putin this evening, as he is talking about referendums in four regions of Ukraine that he will then absorb into the country. These are sham referendums, sham votes. And then, of course, the energy crisis. Europe is about to enter a very bleak and dark winter. And with Putin playing politics with natural gas and also Europe really cutting off their access or allowing countries to access exports from Russia of oil this winter is going to be incredibly challenging. So it's almost a meeting to talk about the future of Ukraine and what's going on the ground right now in that country, as well as an oil and gas summit.
Well, when it comes to Russia and the intentions with Ukraine, you earlier, Anne-Marie, caught up with the NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg from the UN Rose Garden. Let's listen to what he had to say to you.
Such sham votes, referendums, do not have any legitimacy, and therefore they don't change the nature of the conflict. This remains a war of aggression by Russia against the independent sovereign nation in Europe, Ukraine. This will only further worsen the situation, and therefore we need to provide more support to Ukraine.
a very difficult situation and talking about support. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, I mean, Anne-Marie, in your conversations you're having, you will have, I mean, what stood out for you in that conversation specifically?
Well, he's in line with, I also quickly spoke to two Ukrainian officials after this news came out, and they were not surprised because Putin has done this before in Crimea, most notably in 2014. On top of that, one Ukrainian official said to me, well, if I declare myself a prince, so what? The world is going to recognize me as a prince? What they are saying is this does not change the actualities on the ground. And what they are, the Ukrainians are here asking for is more weapons. What you hear from NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg is that he wants to keep this unity within Europe, even though he's very well aware of how difficult, especially for Europe and the Western allies, it is going to be this winter. He wants to keep this unity, and he says that they will sustain the weapons and ammunition until the war is over. But obviously, there's no timeline on that. The concerns is that, of course, with Putin annexing, basically, these regions, the Donbass, as well as Kherson, and also Zaporizhia, would mean that he would use that and say to his people, I have now a success, after we saw that counteroffensive from Ukraine. On top of that, he would consider the Kremlin, as well, would consider this their legal territory, meaning there are many individuals who are concerned about Putin escalating this into the nuclear territory or the chemical weapons territory.
What is the discussion about how to prevent that from happening, not just in the United States, but from world leaders who are here as part of the UN General Assembly?
They say, and you saw the president say on 60 Minutes, there would be, quote, consequences, but they will not tell you what those consequences would be. But I think what they are trying to make sure is that they also use this to, when they talk to their partners and their allies, as this is the reason why we also need to stick together. Because for them, they feel as though, especially in Europe, on their doorstep, this isn't just a war in Ukraine. This isn't just a war in Eastern and South Ukraine. This could potentially inflict all of us and already is changing the landscape of Europe.
And Maria, I did want to ask you, it's always key when we've got someone on the ground there, what is kind of the scene, the mood at the UN? I'm thinking this is, it's been very different, the UN, after 2 years of the pandemic. It's much more normal, I guess you could say, although we are living in certainly very unusual times. Set the scene for us.
Well, the topics are depressing, right? We're talking about a war, we're talking about an energy crisis, we're talking about food security. I was at a panel discussion on the sidelines of the UN talking about food security in Latin America, which most countries import all these fertilizers. They are dealing with almost deathly inflation in Latin America and the Caribbean. But when you talk about the fact that all these leaders and their teams are able to gather together, as we have really not been able to do in terms of massive UN gatherings because of COVID, it's quite jovial on the sidelines. You see individuals being able to come out of their security details and have a conversation with journalists or meet each other. So in that sense, there is this expectation that they can get some work done on the sidelines of this meeting because it is in person, and usually things get done a lot quicker then.
Hey, Anne-Marie, just in the 30 seconds that we have left with you, you've got a lot of big interviews coming up. You got another one coming up later today on BTV. Who are you talking to?
So I'm going to be sitting down with the foreign minister of Qatar, and really at a critical moment because we have Scholz of Germany, the German chancellor, heading over to Doha this weekend. And we know that he is trying to secure LNG deals again. This UN General Assembly is basically coming down to an oil and gas conference because you have European officials trying to secure supplies before they go into the dead of winter. So that'll be one of the main topics we discuss in the sit-down.
All right. Busy day. You're on it for us. We appreciate it. Our own Anne-Marie Horden, she covers the White House and so much more. She's joining us from outside the UN. This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Well, we mentioned the Ford news, and even though we're watching that and the Ford stock falling off, among our most read on the Bloomberg today is one on General Motors and how GM wants to be the tortoise, not the hare, when it comes to the great EV race.
Yeah, this excerpt is in the upcoming issue of Business Week magazine. You can read it now, though. It's on the Bloomberg terminal and at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. It's adapted from David Welch's new book, Charging Ahead, GM, Mary Barra, and the Reinvention of an American Icon. David Welch is Detroit Bureau Chief for Bloomberg News. He joins us on the phone from Detroit. Also with us is Joel Weber, the editor of Bloomberg Business Week. He's with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. Joel, when you think about EVs, we of course think of Tesla, but increasingly we're talking about a company like Ford with the Mach-E and the F-150 Lightning. Where does GM fall into this?
Well, they were early, right? Like, that, what's interesting about this, I mean, they weren't as early as Tesla, but GM was out early. Mary Barra, like, really was forward in telling everyone that GM was going to be...
Big on EVs.
And yet, here we are, and it's like, wait, where is GM exactly? And you know, what was interesting when David and I started talking about his book was sort of that this was actually the plan. Yeah. Like that Mary Barra said, we're going to be a little bit slow, but it's all going to be worth it. So David, what's the rationale there?
GM at its heart is a really pragmatic company. And one thing people forget about Mary Barra because they see her as the first female CEO is she's an engineer. And her sidekick, Mark Royce, is also an engineer. So for the first time since probably the 60s, the company's run by engineers. They don't go for buzz. They don't try to jam a battery in an existing vehicle to get on the cover of Business Week, although that Lightning cover was really, really well done by my colleague.
Zing!
Wow, that was a good one, too.
They decide, okay, we're going to build a battery pack that can host everything from a little Chevy Equinox, and actually even smaller. They're working on subcompacts for global markets, all the way up to this huge 9,000-pound Hummer and everything in between, and they're going to build their battery plant. So, other than Tesla, GM has the only battery plant making battery packs and cells. It's in Lordstown, Ohio. It's going right now. The second one is going to open in Spring Hill, Tennessee, near the old Saturn plant next year. Again, engineering mindset, get your building blocks in place, get your plants up, then you spawn this huge family of EVs. And that's really where they are. One could fault them for relying on the Chevy Bolt, which has been around since 2016, and it's a compact car. Americans hate compacts. I think they rode that a little too long before coming up with something else. But in a way, this really was the plan.
So, and just to respond to your zinger there, easy day to poke fun at my Ford cover with Ford tumbling.
I was saying it was a great cover.
Yeah, but you know, the great thing about... what your story really hinges on is this Ultium, which is the battery platform. So what is GM hoping to accomplish there? And you know, we'll talk a little bit more about where they've been with the Volt, but like, where does this potentially allow them to go?
So right now they've got two luxury electric vehicles in production. They've got the big Hummer and they've got a Cadillac Lyriq. And this is sort of historic GM, goes back to Alfred Sloan. Start off with your coolest stuff and your luxury brands, and then slowly go down the scale. And next year, they'll have Chevy Silverado pickup, which a year behind, but will compete with the F-150 Lightning. Then they have the Chevy Blazer, midsize SUV, family car for a lot of people. Not super cheap, but pretty cheap. It's $45,000, $50,000, which these days is about what a new car costs. Then, about this time next year, the Chevy Equinox. The Equinox, now that no one buys family sedans anymore, the Equinox is really Chevy's family car. And they're going to start this thing at $30,000, which, other than the Bolt, which, again, compact car, Americans don't like compacts, will be the cheapest on the market. And it really, to me, that is, it's two things. It's really the fruit of this whole Ultium thing. They believe they've got the scale and the platform where they can democratize electric vehicles by bringing mass market family car to people who don't have three other four expensive vehicles in their garage. And the other thing is, it really is a litmus test for how ready middle America is to go with battery powered vehicles and charge up.
So,
but to me, it's what really Ultium is all about is you know, if they can sell EVs to everybody.
The secret sauce seems to be this Ultium battery. And you write that it's really about changing the way cars are made. So what's different? What's different in the process?
Ultium is basically it's a battery pack that makes up the floor of the vehicle.
Okay.
And then you know, this is way oversimplification. The guys in the factories are.
You're not doing that because I'm a girl, are you? I am the daughter of an engineer, so you can go with it. No,
I'm doing it because assembly is boring. But you're basically bolting whatever vehicle it is on top of that skateboard kind of platform. It's not quite a skateboard, but close enough. It's so you can, and it's also sort of a Lego set. So if you need to build it longer or wider or shorter or whatever, you can do that. The other thing they can do, and this is what they've done with the Hummer, you can actually stack them on top of each other. So if you have a big, heavy vehicle that has 1,000 horsepower, which the Hummer does, so you need a lot of power on board, you can just add more battery, which means you have more electricity by stacking these cells on top of each other. So you can have a big and wide, and you can stack them up for more energy. There's just, you know, it really is kind of like a Lego set. You know, they're not the only ones who are going to do this. Volkswagen is starting something very similar right about now, but everybody else in the industry, except for Tesla, is kind of going where GM and Volkswagen are headed to get a lot of vehicles out quickly. And both, if you look at it, GM and Volkswagen are the two who have earmarked billions of dollars and many, many vehicles coming. At least the two did it first. Ford has caught up. Others are planning on it. But in terms, well, what this really is, this is commercializing electric vehicles. Mm-hmm. The battery itself doesn't have any special chemistry or special sauce. It's a commercialization and an industrial plan.
And, you know, it's interesting, you know, in addition to this Ford news that our colleagues broke today, we also had this Hertz news that Hertz is going to get into this. So clearly to have the scale and bring the cost down, you know, Hertz is liking what they see out of GM. But so how does that kind of fit into Barra's master plan here?
So GM's plan is to sell 1 million EVs in the U.S. by 2025. And I think really the only one who would be probably doing that by then would be Tesla. And, you know, some analysts say GM could be ahead by then, or could say it's a dog fight, you know, whatever. It's all forecasting. But it gives GM a lot of different vehicles and a lot of potential, a lot of production and therefore potential sales volume. So Hertz likes what they see because they're saying they're going to buy vehicles from five different GM brands. So Buick, Cadillac, Chevrolet, GMC, and also BrightDrop, which is GM's commercial van business. FedEx has already ordered some electric vans from this BrightDrop unit that GM has going. And so clearly, Hertz sees enough that GM's got enough production in their plan where over the next 5 years, they can buy 175,000 EVs off of them. They pledged to buy 100,000 from Tesla. Mm-hmm. So they're going to buy even more from GM. So the production is going to be there.
All right. Well, it's all and so much more in a new book by our own David Welch. He's Detroit Bureau Chief, Bloomberg News, on the phone from Detroit. His book, Charging Ahead, GM Mary Barra and the Reinvention of an American Icon. It's also in the new issue of Business Week coming out. Our thanks to Jill Weber, editor of the magazine.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
We've said this a lot, and yet it really feels like it's ringing true when it comes to tomorrow's FOMC decision. It is a big one in terms of tone, sentiment, and outlook. So we've got the perfect guest to get to about it.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to chatting with Stephen Skanke all week. He's chief economic advisor at Keel Point. He's also former U.S. Treasury and White House National Security Council staff member. He joins us on the phone from Washington, D.C. Dr. Skanke, Stephen, how are you?
I'm great, Tim. Thanks. Great to be with you and Carol.
Hi.
Yeah, one thing that we love is having you join us ahead of these Fed meetings. So Carol mentioned that tomorrow's is especially big. We understand, you know, whether it's going to be 75 or 100 basis points, but what else are you looking for in terms of commentary from the Fed chair?
Well, what's really going to be telling tomorrow is their summary of economic projections, which comes out. The last one was in June. Before that, it was March, and you know what was interesting is the big changes from March to June, and it'll be really interesting to see whether there's big changes from the June summary of economic projections to September.
How often do they change? And, I mean, how reliable are they in terms of really figuring out what is the trajectory? And Steve, I ask that because, you know, our Lisa Abramowitz earlier in Surveillance, I was listening in this morning, and she's like, kind of hate the dot plot because it can change so quickly depending on the economic data points. The Fed can change it up. So I'm just wondering, you know, how much real visibility that we can rely on will we get with the projections or with the Fed commentary?
Well, Carol, it comes out every 3 months. And it's a reflection of what the members of the FOMC are seeing in the data that they're looking at. So the regional bank presidents are part of it. They're telling us what's going on in their regions. And then, of course, the governors. And it can change, but it's a reflection of what they're thinking. And it's what they're thinking that tells us a lot about what they're going to be doing next.
How else can we get an idea into what they're thinking, apart from the dot plot, as Carol calls it, the scatter plot? Is that what you call it?
Yeah, the scatter plotter.
Scatter plotter.
But I mean, is there a question, and just building on what Tim's saying, Steve, is there a question that you think is crucial to be asked to or of Jay Powell that will give us some idea about what comes next?
Yes, the question is how satisfied are they with the outlook for inflation? And it would be nice to know whether he thinks that what they're doing with the Fed's funds rate is actually making a difference. You know, this inflation situation is different than what we've had before. It's not so much excess demand, although there is some of that. But the big issue is getting supply up again. Failure of folks to come back into the labor market, although we did see a little bit more coming back in August, and just production has been problematic. And so raising interest rates will help a little bit, but it also has the negative side effect of making it more expensive for businesses to get production and service up.
Yeah, and look what it's done to the housing market already, because that's been something that's happening with the yield on the 10-year moving higher, mortgage rate 6% now, Steve. Hey, I'm wondering how long it takes for what the Fed does to actually show up in the economy past what we've spoken about, in a way that will actually, you know, we talk about the strength of the labor market over and over again, and as much as the Fed chair doesn't want to say it, that he wants, you know, more people to, you know, essentially be out of work. He wants it to weaken. How long does that take? When do we start to see that in the labor market?
Well, the lag time can be a little bit funny. It's anywhere from 6 months to 18 months. And what's different right now is that there is so much liquidity in the system. You know, the Fed's balance sheet is almost $9 trillion. 14 years ago, it was $850 billion. So with all of that liquidity in the system, raising the Fed funds rate and even if they were trying to raise other rates, doesn't have so much of an impact as it would before. Now, certainly an inversion of the yield curve will make a difference because banks will slow down their lending. But it's a little bit hard for some of their traditional policy tools to be effective.
So, in terms of the conversation that the FOMC is having, they kicked off that two-day meeting today. What do you think is top of mind right now? Is it just the I don't mean to belittle by saying just the inflation numbers, but is that what it's all about ultimately?
It is, Carol.
Yeah.
You remember the Who song, 1971 song, "Won't Get Fooled Again." Jay Powell got fooled by inflation after his speech at Jackson Hole last year, where there was a little bit of a head fake on inflation, and the Fed didn't really step up some things so much. And you know, really, even back in March of this year, at their summary of economic projections, they were talking about the Fed funds rate reaching 1.9% this year, by the end of this year. And then, of course, in June, they had raised that to 3.4%, and now it looks like it's more likely to be about 4.5% by the time they get to the end of the year. They don't want to be fooled again, and the rhetoric reflects it.
Well, the bond market's certainly telling you or telling us what it thinks when it comes to Fed policy, because we've seen, you know, a lot of Treasury yields along the curve just moving to multi-year highs. Steve Skanke, Dr. Steve Skanke, Chief Economic Advisor over at Kill Point, former U.S. Treasury and White House National Security Council staff member, joining us once again on the phone from Washington, D.C. That Fed decision, 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Wednesday, tomorrow, right here on Bloomberg.
When cybercriminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing. The passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
Keep driving crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, everybody, just about 10 minutes left in today's trading session. About 10 and a half bouncing around, man, in a big way. We're off our highs and lows, but we've seen some buying come back into the market in the last couple of hours. Of course, by this time tomorrow, we will know the latest Fed decision and Fed thinking about the outlook.
Yeah, it's funny, Carol. Today's not like hurry up and wait when it comes to the market.
It's not funny. This is serious stuff, too.
I know, but I'm just saying it's like, you know, funny in the interesting way. All right, yes. I want to clarify for everyone listening. Brent Schuette is with us. He's Chief Investment Officer at Northwestern Mutual Wealth Management. He joins us on the phone from Milwaukee. Brent, great to have you with us. It's really interesting seeing, you know, in the equity trade today, it's not at all investors kind of sitting back and waiting for what Jay Powell is going to do. It sort of seems like they've decided what he's going to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think you've seen some more negative sentiment come on the market in the past few days after the heightened CPI report. I guess it's kind of more of a back and forth, though, at least today. And I think there are some people like me who are thinking the Fed may decide to start saying the word but. So Jerome Powell hopefully will talk about all the things about inflation being high and apologize for that and saying he wants to fight that in the future. But I think he needs to acknowledge that despite that backward-looking CPI number, that more forward indicators are pointing to lower inflation and that they will be coming down the road. It's just how much patience does he actually have until he gets those.
So, you know, Brent, you've been investing for, a couple of decades or so on and watching these financial markets and different cycles, and you think about what you have seen in that period from the tech bubble, the run-up, the bubble, the financial crisis, real estate meltdown, and then the pandemic, and kind of here where we are today. How do you really figure out what this market cycle is, or are we just kind of learning as we go?
I think this one's more unique than any other one. I've never seen a shut down the economy, open it back up, have goods spending surge 20% in 1 year on a real basis. So think about that. Goods spending up 20% in 1 year in 1 month, how that stressed the supply chains and then caused the goods inflation. And so I've seen some really odd things this time. that I think make it a bit different and a bit difficult to figure out where we are in the business cycle. I think the key things that I see, the Fed talks about slowing demand, and I hear people talking about demand still holding up. I think people need to wake up that we're on our possibly third straight negative quarter of GDP. Hmm. Overall consumption is growing at a 2% year-over-year pace, so it has slowed dramatically, especially on the good side. Leading economic indicators will be out tomorrow. They're going to be negative on a year-over-year basis. There's been a few times they've been negative and we haven't had a recession, but they're pointing that way. The housing market's gone from boom to bust, and you're seeing inventories rebuilt. And so if you put these things together in mosaic, it's logical to believe that inflation is set to fall. The one thing that is probably still sticking out is that labor market, which is key to decide where you're at in the cycle. And that depends on if people come back or not. So that's where it really the rubber meets the road.
So when does inflation start to fall?
Well, I think it's already started to fall, but I think it's certainly a back and forth. And then you have to pick your inflation number. Is it the 8.3% headline CPI or is it the 4.6% core PCE? That's where there's a huge difference right now, and I'm sure you have people come on your show with a different with an outlook, and they kind of base their outlook based upon what number they see. Look, inflation, I think, is set to fall. It's hard to imagine it holding up. Even though the labor market's doing well, you want to know in the University of Michigan what consumers said they expect their wages to be in the next year?
Right.
1.7% gain. And so I don't see evidence that inflation is embedded in the economy. I don't see evidence that the spending splurge that we have is set to continue. And so I think inflation will come down. It's just how quickly does it come down? And the Fed is so afraid of the ghost of the 1970s that they lose their credibility, and that's why they're talking tough. But I think they need to back away now because they're starting to cause real economic damage. And I think inflation's set to lower even without causing any more damage.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it's just inflation has been so sticky for so much longer than everybody anticipated that you can understand maybe the nervousness among the Fed withdrawing quickly. So do you think then the Fed move tomorrow should be it for a while or done with this cycle?
No, I think what the market would look for and what I'd look for is that the extraordinary high hikes, the 75 basis point ones, the Fed floats a trial balloon about considering not having more of those in the future and see what happens to inflation expectations, which, by the way, across the bond market, across the consumers, are not elevated. In many cases, they're back to where they were in 2014, which is right before we had that period of time where we worried about deflation. And so I'm not very sure they're done. We'll see. I think it depends on how inflation comes down. And then that's where I think when people say it's sticky because the housing number is calculated on a lag. The Fed can keep tightening all they want. They can destroy the housing market, and it won't show up in the data probably for another 6 months to a year.
Okay.
And so how much more do you want to do?
Okay, that's a good point because we keep questioning some of the housing statistics.
Yeah.
Anyway, Tim, I know you've got a good question.
Yeah, I want to ask a little bit about cash. And I'm wondering if we can consider cash in a portfolio, T-bills, for example, really be considering its own asset class at this point because rates are so high.
Yeah, I think so. And I think the important message here is that, and what I hear when I talk to retail clients and retail investors is that people don't want to own bonds any longer across the curve. Oh. I think the really interesting thing is that you've repriced the bond market, which is why the stock market has repriced, because those two are connected. The growth stocks repriced the most. And to me, bonds now actually provide, once again, a hedge against an adverse outcome like a recession. And so, you know, I just think people should be not focused on what happened in the past and the reality that the bond market's down around 13% this year, but focus more on the future. And at 3.5% on the 10-year treasury, there's at least real yield, or is it realer yield? I don't know how you say it. I'm depending upon what you think inflation is going to be. And so I would advise people to think of cash, to think of bonds, again, as something that can hedge against adverse impacts.
All right. If you want to be in the equity market, my understanding is you want to own things that are cheaper. So you're looking at value in small cap in particular.
Yeah. And I mean, that's where we've said consistently for the past year and a half that you wanted to first hedge yourself by owning commodities. So I was the person looking for inflation. We actually own TIPS, those that we have recommended getting rid of, but we still own commodities. We owned gold because we didn't think bonds provided, in many cases, an outcome, a great hedge. We want to be in things that are cheaper. I mean, those tend to do better when rates are higher. And they're quite a bit of protection against falling earnings expectations. Mm. And that's where I do think, you know, people are worried that's coming.
Yeah.
It might be, it probably is. But if you have cheaper stocks, all else being equal, you have a margin of safety.
All right. Thank you so much, Brent. Really appreciate it. Brent Schuette, he is Chief Investment Officer over at Northwestern Mutual Wealth Management, joining us on the phone from Milwaukee.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
The Big Take from Bloomberg News brings you what's shaping the world's economies with the smartest and best-informed business reporters around the world.
We cover the stories behind what's moving money and markets
and help you understand what's happening, what it means, and why it matters every afternoon. I'm Sarah Holder.
I'm Saleha Mohsen.
And I'm David Gura. Listen to The Big Take and Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.